You are listening to Kubernetes Bytes, a podcast bringing you the latest from the world of cloud-native data management. My name is Ryan Wallner, and I'm joined by Bhavin Shah, coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. We'll be sharing our thoughts on recent cloud-native news and talking to industry experts about their experiences and challenges managing the wealth of data in today's cloud-native ecosystem.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. And we are coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. Today is January 8th, 2024. Hope everyone is doing well and staying safe. Let's dive into it. Happy New Year, everyone. Kubernetes Bytes is back. So we just finished season 3 with an AIML intro or 101 episode. Hope you guys like that. And we are excited to jump into the season 4 or 2024 season with an exciting episode with a Kubernetes user. Before we actually go into the topic for today and introduce our guest, let's talk about what's going on with the cloud native ecosystem.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Recently, I know we were off for like a few weeks, so there are we do have a lot of exciting news to cover. Let's start by talking about some funding rounds and some acquisitions. Talking about funding rounds, Aqua Security, the Kubernetes security vendor with their open source project Trivi, raised an additional $60 million funding for a total of $325 million raised through their lifetime. This looks like an extension Series E round based on their website and Crunchbase's site, which basically like helped them maintain their valuation over $1 billion. So congrats for still being a unicorn, Aquarians. Is that what they call them? I don't know, but congrats, Aqua Security. Next up, we have Docker buys a small startup called Atomic Jar to integrate their container-based test automation tools, specifically something called as the Test Container Projects. Test Container Projects are open source, multi-language library for providing throwaway, lightweight instances of database, message queues, web browsers, anything that you can package in a container, they can deliver it to you to for your test dev workflows. So go and check that out. We'll have a link for it in the show notes. They didn't say how much the acquisition was for or how many people will join the team, but like looks like the entire Atomic Jar team will now be part of Docker as well, including all of their open source projects and efforts. Next up, in terms of acquisitions, Harness.io, a key player in the continuous delivery ecosystem, buys another CDE startup called Armory. So Armory, and looks like they bought it for like $7 million based on Business Insider information. Armory had raised more than $80 million, so it's sad that now they had to sell themselves for $7 million. But hey, like the technology is still around. I'm hoping the people at Armory still have a job. So that's the way to get an exit, I guess. But yeah, Harness adds to its tool chest or war chest and add more tools to its ecosystem. Next up, talking about a funding round, Scale Ops, a very small startup, I think based out of Israel, raises $15 million in Series A round, bringing the total money raised to $21.5 million. And Scale Ops, as the name suggests, helps organizations scale their Kubernetes deployments, Kubernetes clusters, and do that cost effectively, right? So based on their website, it looks like they do dynamic pod resizing for compute and memory. So your CPU and memory requests and limits, but they do that dynamically instead of having you to instead of asking the user to update those limits every time. They also optimize the nodes that are part of your Kubernetes cluster. So I'm sure I'm like thinking about this as an offering that works for public cloud or managed Kubernetes platforms to begin with. So in terms of node optimizations, they help by removing under-provisioned nodes. So if your nodes are not utilized fully, it'll remove those nodes by moving the pods that were running on those underutilized nodes to different other nodes in the clusters. They also help you by replacing expensive nodes that your developers might have asked for by cheaper ones, just because they know how much capacity, both from a compute, memory, and storage, is actually needed by your workloads. And then it also consolidates pods for more efficient compute utilization. So looks like they're mostly focused on compute. Again, I won't say that they are the first vendor in the ecosystem, but definitely like bringing more light to this space, right? Where given the market that we are in right now, given that all the ZERP or zero interest rate projects are kind of done for almost a year, this will help organizations maintain their Kubernetes environments and do so cost effectively, right? Next up, we have another acquisition. I know it's been a busy 3 weeks. Like, who would have thought over Christmas and New Year breaks or over holidays, we'll see a lot of funding rounds and acquisitions. But this one is a big one. Cisco actually acquires Isovalent. So Isovalent, if you don't know, which will be weird, but they are the company behind the Cilium project, the Tetragon project. They do a lot of good things in the CNI ecosystem. The eBPF ecosystems are now part of Cisco Securities Business Group. The acquisition, again, the intent to acquire was announced. I think the acquisition is supposed to complete in like third quarter of this year. No price was actually being shared, but looking at the history, right, Isovalent had raised $69 million through its Series A and Series B. And importantly, Cisco was already part of both of these funding rounds. And again, Cisco specifically, I'm talking about the venture arm that they have. So Cisco had already invested in Isovalent over the couple of rounds. Personally, I think this is a great move, right? Cisco, I've worked on Cisco switches, Cisco Nexus and iOS switches in the past, and I've seen how widely used they are. This just means that, okay, with Cilium being that open source project and Cilium has how it has become the default CNI plugin for EKS and AKS and GKE, this helps Cisco, I don't know, at least maintain their presence even in this cloud native ecosystem, right? So great move by Cisco. Congrats to everyone at Isovalent. You have a new home now. One last news that's not related to acquisitions or funding rounds. We have Kubernetes 1.29 went out. I think it, somewhere in mid-December. It was after we published our AIML episode. So we didn't cover it then, but yeah, it's GA for everyone to use. That was the last release of 2023, just in time, right? Because if they pushed anything during Christmas, I don't think that might have been picked up as well. This is a good stable release, 49 enhancements. 11 of those features moved to stable, 19 graduated to beta, and 19 graduated to beta and 19 to alpha. Sorry, I was looking at my notes here. A couple of things that caught my eye from the stable announcements or the stable enhancements. Read-write once pod, which was in beta till now, is now a stable feature. So if you are using persistent volumes or data on Kubernetes, you know that the access modes are read-write once, read-write many. Now we have read-write once pod. This is, again, the way to differentiate this is if you're using read-write once, you would think that only one pod will have access to that specific persistent volume, but read-write once actually gave or could give access to all the pods running on one node in your Kubernetes cluster access to that persistent volume. So this, I guess, restricts it even further. Now it makes it read-write once pods. So only one pod can have access to a volume at one time. So go look at it if that's something that you're interested in. And then second thing that caught my eye was KMS v2 encryption at rest is available for all Kubernetes resources in your cluster. So a reliable solution to encrypt all resources. We'll have a link in the show notes that talks about how to do that. Again, this feature has been around. KMS V1 was around for a while. KMS V2 has been in beta for a while. This is now just generally available. That's it for news for this episode. I know we had a few articles and announcements, but let me move to the next step and talk about our guest for today, right? So we have Ahmed Baybars, Ahmed, if I butchered your last name, but he's a staff software engineer working for the New York Times. So as part of season 4, we want to strive towards getting more and more of these user stories. I know each season we move from like doing more one-on-one episodes to bringing on more vendors and startup founders to talk about what's new and exciting. This year, we also want to focus on getting more user perspectives. The feedback that we got after the Chick-fil-A episode that we did last year and the Major League Baseball episode that we did last year was exciting, just to summarize it in a single word. So we will strive to get more and more users using Kubernetes on a day-to-day basis to join us for a pod episode and talk about their experience. So if you are one of those users, please reach out to us. We would love to have you on the episode. Again, doesn't matter if you are like a New York Times or a Major League Baseball, even if you are like a 10% team and you're using Kubernetes, we would love to hear from you and make sure and have you share your experiences with the rest of our listeners. Okay, so without further ado, let's bring Ahmed on. Hey, Ahmed, welcome to Kubernetes Bytes podcast. Happy New Year, and thank you for joining us. Why don't we start with like a quick introduction of who you are, what you do at New York Times, and then we can kick off the official episode.
Sure. First of all, Happy New Year to you. And thanks for having me. Really excited about talking about Kubernetes and what are we doing at the New York Times. So my name is Ahmed Bibars. I'm a staff software engineer at the New York Times, specifically in delivery engineering. And our focus is to like maintain and build like core infrastructure and develop a centralized platform for our product engineering team to help them with their building their applications, services, and all of that kind of stuff. And I work with multiple teams inside the organization from like CI/CD, Kubernetes, so like CDNs and other things.
Okay, awesome. Is it just one team that supports all product engineering teams inside the New York Times, or do you have like multiple teams supporting different organizations?
So it really depends on each. Yeah, so like we are in missions and like depending on like what does your goal look like. So in delivery engineering, we have multiple teams are specifically to different areas like CI/CD. We have my team is like working on like Kubernetes, but like I also work with the CDN team and doing like all of the service delivery or the traffic delivery. And then like the teams are responsible for resources provisioning and like all of the cloud stuff.
Gotcha.
And then we have teams for developer experience. So it's really like an organization that tries to centralize the entire process and building a central platform to make it like more standard and also like avoid, you know, any kind of productivity cut from like, I'm trying to maintain my infrastructure, I'm trying to do this, things like that.
Okay. That's good, right? So let's start with basics. I know you are on the Kubernetes Bytes podcast. So like, let's start by talking about when and why did you and New York Times choose to go down the containers and Kubernetes route? How was that decision made and what are some of the benefits that you see?
Yeah, so I've been with the Times for about 5 years now. I cannot talk before that. But like, my understanding is like a lot of teams are using Kubernetes even like before we started like a central platform. But like you can imagine like I'm a team, I'm building my own clusters and I'm running my own things. And another team doing that and like every team is doing wherever they feel it's empowered to deliver their services because that's we need to have. So the other thing is like when we started like our journey to like make things centralized and build a platform that like makes life easier to every engineer and makes just the process smoother, we thought about like what is the right tool that we can build containers on. Or even before containers, like what is the right tool to ship runtime? And like with all of the ecosystem and we're seeing like Kubernetes happening and all of the kind of work in there, we thought like Kubernetes could be a good tool since it's open source, it's more like cloud agnostic, it sets in all of the cloud providers and you can do it on premise if you need to. So that's where like we decided about like maybe like 2 years ago when we started thinking about the platform or the central platform, that's the tool that we're going to build the platform on top.
Okay. No, I think that makes sense, right? And that's what we see in the community as well. Like instead of having developers or individual application teams reinvent the wheel and try to do everything on their own, having like larger organizations that can obviously afford to have a centralized platform team going down the route. We also have like a fancy term called platform engineering that kind of is that umbrella term that covers all of these things. So I guess my question to you, next question to you is about like when you started this journey at the Times, right? Did you start with some open source project to build your IDP or internal developer platform? Or did you end up building something that's more custom to you, that's more proprietary to the Times?
That's a very good question. So like with every platform, you're trying to not reinvent the wheel. So you're trying to see what's available in the market and then like what's happening and then like you customize on top of it. Yeah. So when we started, we saw like Kubernetes, it's going to be the good tool for doing that. So what other components that we were looking for? And looking at the open source, we were already like doing like some stuff specifically on EKS. So, mm-hmm. but then we were looking into what other things that we can use. So we needed, like, for example, like network isolation. So we need like network policy and all of that kind of stuff. While Kubernetes provides some of these, but we need something that we can, because we are running a multi-tenant architecture. Yeah. That was our decision. So we decided like Cilium is a good approach. There are a couple products, but we decided to go with Cilium. So another thing we need to ensure that all of the policies and everything is intact. We have governance and all of that kind of stuff. So gatekeepers come to the mix. Then later through the process, we were thinking about service mesh. So Istio came to the process and then we started using it. Then we start to use cluster autoscaler, but things change a bit. And like we start to look at Carpenter. But these are all open source tools that we're using. However, there are some other things that we are building in-house. So for example, like we try to automate the process of how to onboard teams and accounts to our Kubernetes cluster. So we built like a controller that like based on some triggers that does like when an event happened, let's from there start build the CRD, all of the kind of stuff. So we have some controllers that we built in the platform to help us with the process, but we try to rely more on like a lot of open source tools so we can like ship things faster and also have the ability to contribute upstream and we don't have to, you know, recode everything.
That makes sense. Okay, so you already described a lot of your tech stack today. I know you said you use EKS as a distribution. Is Times all focused on AWS EKS, or are you also like multi-cloud?
It really depends. Like this is not an area like where like we would think this way. I believe that was the ways that I would think of it. Like when we decided to like where we were going to build the platform, we have some thoughts about like where it's going to be. And I think like we decided on like going building the platform on top of AWS for now, because EKS provide us with the tools. But like at any point of time, you know, you can be a multi-cloud, but I think it's an investment that you have to make and decisions that you would make to ensure like do we really need it or not, like how we would do that. There are always a say that like things are cloud agnostic, but like come to a point where like you have to change providers, you have to change a lot of things, so it's not like an easy decision to go for, but I think for now like we are using EKS as a Kubernetes distribution for the platform.
And yeah, I agree, like there is going to be lock-in at some layer of the stack. Like you can't be completely vendor agnostic. That will be basically saying you're building everything in-house, and
it's
not worth the juice is not worth the squeeze, I guess. So talking more about your platform, right? You said you support a lot of application teams. Do you have like, so the reason I'm asking this is I've used Backstage a bit and seen tools that are built on top of Backstage, and it has a nice user interface that developers can use to select these apps or select these golden paths to get started. Does something similar exist inside your platform that you have built, or is it? I've also seen scenarios where developers are used to using just Kubernetes CRDs. So once you have clusters for them, they can create the right CRDs and get access to what they need. Which way are you leaning?
Okay, so I can tell you like my opinion, and I can tell you what are we doing. So like, first of all, what are we doing? So I think like the main important piece here is like we think about like the productivity and the developer experience. So like, while I can give you all of the tools to do whatever you need, it's going to be like super less opinionated and all of that kind of stuff. I still didn't get you like that easy, quick golden pathway. I'm just like having a bunch of tools compiled together and say, hey, these are the tools that you can use. So I think like to take a step back, we thought about the platform in a workflow way. So like, what are you trying to do? Like I'm trying to onboard. So like if you are trying to onboard, you go to a form, you go to our interface, and that's gonna onboard you. What is this onboarding gonna do? Is gonna create like a few things for you. So now I'm trying to choose container runtime. Like this is gonna be Kubernetes at the moment. So what else? So if I describe the entire flow for you, it's the first step is onboarding and then develop. The onboarding step, it's exactly what you meant about interface and user enter some information. Like I need to use that. I need to use this CI. I need to use Argo. What's my service look like? I'm exposing it public or not? And then like this templating engine will create all of the resources from like a Git repo, like all of that templates that you need from like Customize or Helm, wherever all of this look like. And then there are a few CRDs that we're talking about here. Like maybe we have a CRD for our traffic management. Mm-hmm. That's something we built that will get templated for you based on the information. Okay. So from start to end, like when you set up, like when you enter your information for the service that you are trying to deploy till you get to production, we're talking about like 10 minutes to get there least with a template. Like we say go, and then you get like a HTTP server, for example, and that helps you to not think about how I would do a lot of things, but like all of these are shipped out and then you can customize and build on top of it.
Okay. So as part of the onboarding workflow, right, when they request for a certain amount of resources, like, is it such that, like, do you have like a huge Kubernetes or EKS cluster and developers get their own namespace for that multi-tenant environment? Or do you have like a cluster as a service or a cluster vending machine where every developer gets their own small 3-node, 4-node cluster based on what they want to do?
Yeah, very good question. And I spoke about this in large in multiple talks that I have done. But we decided to go with a multi-tenant approach. Okay. So we have like specific clusters, cross environments, cross regions that like we deploy people, we deploy like applications to them. Gotcha. So you can get more than one namespace. It's something that we already provide out of the box. But like when we onboard you as a tenant or as an like an entire account, we give you a default namespace with everything that is a controller that I spoke about earlier. You get like your network policies, you get like your SCO gateways, you get all of the stuff that you want to get out of the box. Even if you are not onboarding through the platform, you still can use Kubernetes out of the box within the setup that we have. But if you take it to the other end and you use the platform as a whole, you get the whole experience from that. But we also know that not one size fits all. So we have like few use cases where like I need multiple namespaces. So the same controller, you just like write a small CRD and you get the new namespace with all of the default values that we have. So basically, it's a multi-region, multi-tenant, like different nodes and all of the kind of stuff are combined together. And we're thinking about like different, also like I have to be honest, we are still like early in the journey. So things may change. We've been thinking about like, what if we need to dispense one cluster for a specific need? How are we going to do that? Or how things like this would be done?
Okay. No, I think that was a good description, right? Of how you handle multi-tenancy. That leads me to the next question. Like, okay, how do you, like, if you are maintaining your own platform and a huge cluster, how do you do day zero, day two operations? Like, day zero might be okay. You deployed that huge cluster for once and everything is set up. What about day two? How do you handle Kubernetes version upgrades or AMI upgrades? How, and are these disruptive, non-disruptive, transparent to the developer? Can you talk more about that, please?
Yeah, this is like this has been a problem in general. The community has been thinking about like how you do like should I do like blue green? Should I do in place? What kind of tools? So it really depends on like what are we changing. Like, but to be fair, we are trying to be like honest and transparent about how we do upgrades. So like when we try to do any like things that we think that might hit any issue, we always like say, we always like keep everyone posted, hey, we are upgrading this from this version to this version, just to like if you see anything. But like we have more than one environment to test things at.
Okay. So
like, we don't ship things to production directly. It's just like, you know, just normal SDLC software lifecycle. And then like we have a pre-environment that no one has access that we test stuff on, and then like we ship it, you know, iteratively to go to the right place. So we try to handle this. But like there are some stuff that, for example, like one of the things that I'm really happy with how the community think about, for example, like Carpenter is the approach that Carpenter is using for upgrading AMIs is really nice, because like we don't say we need that specific AMI, but we basically say get the latest, for example. And then we have like our setup to expire nodes every certain amount. So that gets us like a new node.
Oh, that's awesome. Wow. Yeah.
So we don't have to maintain like all the, you know, the batching and all of the kind of stuff when we have long time node. From the other hand, when we talk about control plane for EKS specifically, like that's that you know, that's done by AWS. So yep. like we just patch it. And then I think like they keep adding more features about compatibility and other things, but we have to do all of our due diligence from a perspective of like someone using HPE, like V1 beta, for example, and like, you know, V2 came up and like then things start to break and all of that kind of stuff. But yeah, we prefer to do like some in-place upgrade. And that's also having the multi-regional stuff helps because we not necessarily ship to every region. We start like one region and then see how it's reacting and then like go to the other region. That helps also mitigate any problems that might happen through the way.
Okay, that makes sense. So like if you're talking more about the developer experience, right? I want to like, let's say there is a new request from the product team and you have to, the developer has to work on adding a new feature. If it's a really minor feature, how do they go about that, right? Like they'll write their code maybe in their local IDE. Where do they test it? Like where do they run unit tests? How do they, what does the CI/CD pipeline looks like? And are the changes to production automated? I know you said like it's really fast for a developer to get something from laptop to production, but I wanted to see what that process actually looks like.
Yeah, definitely I can speak to that. So when I mentioned earlier, like it's a 10 minute, I was more talking about like that onboarding experience for a new service.
Okay.
It's not any serving any traffic when it's deployed to production. It's just like the domain is there, the service is ready, but there's no actual code.
Yeah.
You talk about like the life cycle in general, like, so we start with like engineers are like testing their code locally, testing how the environment ships, all of that kind of stuff works. And then like, we do have developed like a couple things about making pull request environments. So once you ship a pull request, you get like an environment on top of the platform that like specifically shows you the changes that you have done and that build an image, that build all of the necessary tools behind the scene. And then once you get like the normal review cycle, like everything looks good, you ship it and depend on like some features are fully like goes once you merge it. It's really a preference on how teams work. But like some feature when you merge it to main, it goes to like a life cycle of like now I'm going to do it in dev, auto promotion to staging and do tests and then like continuous integration. Some other teams have to, you know, promoted. It really depends on the use cases.
Okay.
But yeah, like the life cycle is like you go from local to an environment that you test on. It's like similar to the environment that you have in. And then you go to your development, do more tests. And staging is kind of more like the last environment before production where like you test actually everything.
Okay.
And there are other things that we also have. So it really depends on the features, but like you could add smoke test, stress test, integration tests with other features, depending on like if your feature or your service talking to many other internal services in the company or things like that. So it really depends on the situation.
Okay. And do you do any form of production-like tests, right? Like the amount of traffic that New York Times receives on all their different apps is at a different scale than what a developer usually thinks about. So is that involved somewhere? Like we were talking to last year, a company called SpeedScale that basically takes a dump of all the production data, the petabytes and petabytes of data. And then whenever you have your app in that staging environment, they actually test it against the production-like data to see if everything works as expected. And then only they push it to production. Is that something that the Times does and you do at
That's not an area that I'm super familiar with, but I can tell you like there are some teams are might be using like Canary releases to test like a couple things. But there's one thing that I've been seeing recently is that we started, because we are in a centralized place, we start to have features in our ingress. So we have like we built ingress for the platform that does some mirroring. So in that situation, we can like teams can decide like I want to mirror some of the traffic from production on a specific way. And send it somewhere else to test like how's that gonna look like. And there's always, you know, experimentation depending on like how you do it. Why? Because like there's a lot of services have to play a role into like the deployment. But yeah, I have seen some stuff, but it's not an area where like I do a day-to-day operation. Okay. It's more like the app teams where are more familiar with things like that.
Gotcha. That makes sense. So like going back to what you are responsible for, right? Like maintaining the platform. How do you design for or avoid single points of failures, right? Like a node can go down, there might be some outage between AZs, or US East One once in a while might like give you a mini heart attack. How do you plan for those events, right? And like, can you talk about the resiliency that you have built in? And is the developer responsible for doing that at the application layer, or the platform is supposed to own that?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And like, there are different points where like we talk about resiliency. One of them, so I'm going to give you a couple examples. Yep. One of the examples is like the ingress. So the ingress is built automatically to manage failover. So we built it like deployed in multi-region capacity, and your traffic is going already through a multi-region. If one region failed, even if you are deployed to a single region, your traffic goes to the complete other region and like get traversed over the internal network. So that avoids like we have a single place where like traffic will fall down. From other things, like for Kubernetes, for example, we do have service mesh. Mm-hmm. So like clusters in the same environment in two different regions are already meshed together in a way, using Cilium, using Istio. So like if you are deploying your service to multi-region perspective and like one of your region failed, the other region should automatically take over. And most of these features we are trying to give to the engineers out of the box. Like we don't want to like, but we also have a lot of customizations that you can play in. Like you can say, this is a weight that I want to send between. Maybe you are not in active situation, so you are in active passive. Mm-hmm. Depend on like each team requirement. But like most of it, we're trying to think a lot more into like how to take the best practices, implement them, and give all of the teams the freedom and the ability to decide like what features you need to enable or disable, or like what is their specific requirement. But like we all think about this because, you know, like if you centralize the platform, you just want to make sure that it's resilient enough that it can avoid any single point of failures.
Yeah, and that makes sense, right? And I think that centralized team really helps with that because everybody doesn't have to build that logic inside the application layer and spend more time delivering a single feature. They can rely on platform being that resilient layer. But like you spoke about multi-region and an ingress or a load balancer, basically routing traffic based on the availability, right? How do you handle data? Like I think I remember that you don't run data on Kubernetes, like you're leveraging other AWS services, but how does active, like is it active in the first place? And how does it work cross-region?
Yeah. That's a great question. So that's also one of the things that really we are in the early journey. So we are trying to, you know, like you are creating a cluster. If you have volumes and you have all of the kind of stuff, it makes things more complicated, like how you like back up all of this, how you restore them. And we are running like, I think I mentioned earlier that we are running on like a spot mode as well for some EC2 instances so they can go out. So we are trying to use any managed storage that we can leverage to like have everything around. So like, let's say if, for example, like if we are using AWS with EKS, like what other managed storage? Like if you want to save a file, it's probably S3, that would be a great place. If you want to like a database, probably you would go to like RDS, like just like have it there. Like that, components about like how these are deployed might be different from an application to an application. In some use cases, you are just like deploying a file to an S3, so you can afford going from like our West region, for example, to the same S3. But there are other situations where like you have a very sensitive latency. So you may have, let's say, talk about cache, we're talking about Redis. So you may have like two distributed cache in each region, and one can be a leader and one take over when something happened. But like this is really dependent on the situation. I have seen databases where like they are multi-EZ, multi-region, or like a global database where just your access endpoint depends on where you're coming from, that will handle it automatically. I have seen like application decide that I always want to write to one region, and like when a region when there's a failure, there's automation to promote the other database somehow. So it's still like it's also depend on, we offer the capabilities to just be like, you can do like a single deployment, you can do a multi-region, you can do a multi, like we always, all of our clusters are multi-EZs by default, are multi-region. So that solve a couple pieces of problems, but then like you come to like permanent storage or like persistent storage, and then how this is handled, it has a lot of different cases. But we recommend going for manage tools
services.
to help with the whole process in general for your application.
Gotcha. And that makes sense. So that makes sense for like your infrastructure like requirements. One question is like, are these managed services part of your platform? So when they are selecting like, okay, I need X amount of CPU memory resources and I need like an RDS or a DynamoDB instance, do they request it as part of the platform? And then you have maybe like Terraform or CloudFormation on the backend that's actually spinning these up and giving those endpoints to the developers?
Yeah, this is a blend. So currently, like there are a couple of these that might be like have a modules that spins them up, but like the plan in general is to be able also to provide like less options. Like if I know already where's your traffic coming from, I should know like what security group that they applied, all of the kind of data and what's the IAM role. We should like, so for now, for example, couple things that we do, like when you deploy an application to EKS, for example, we give you the ECR, like the Terraform built for it. We give you the ERSA or the service account, like IAM service account for your role. And we give you the Terraform for it built already and deployed. So there are other conversations and discussions about like what else could be an S3, could be a Dynamo table, could be something else. And you just have to choose an option. So I think like that would be like more stuff that comes in and makes the process even easier. From a developer experience perspective.
Oh, I think that's awesome, right? And that's the key thing with a centralized platform team. You have to treat it as like an ever-evolving thing. It's not that, oh, I have some automation and then I can call it a day and work on something else. No, it is about continuously improving the platform and making sure developers are using it. Like if you don't evolve it, they'll be like, okay, this is, I can use the platform only for one specific niche use case, but everything else I have to do it on my own. So I like that approach of it's always going to be, there are always going to be new features to it.
Yeah, exactly. I mentioned, funny enough, that one of my last talk I was talking about, like, was the lesson learned. And I was like, having, like, platform engineering is not a project, it's a product. Yeah. Like, and it has to be iteratively and you have to listen to customers. So it's not like a one thing, exactly like what you're saying. Like, it's not one thing that you're going to do it and then, hey, it's done. It's just like, it's a very many iterations that you have to go through to get to the point where like, now it's working. Now what's next? And all of the kind of stuff.
Okay. So you listed, like you already brought up best practices, right? From your own learnings. We have listeners to the podcast that are in all stages, right? There are organizations that are really matured right along with you and innovating on this front, but there are still organizations that are getting started or development teams that are getting started. Can you share some of your best practices or lessons learned so that people don't repeat them with our listeners?
Yeah, of course. So like, as I'm describing our journey, and I talked about this, whatever I'm describing here is what worked for us. So there is no one size fits all. Like I have seen other people like using cluster as a service, for example, or namespace as a service. Like first of all, you have to look into like, what is the need inside the organization? Like, what are you building for? Like one thing that I have seen is that, oh, we are engineers. So like we tend to like, hey, I want to build a shiny thing. I want to build something that like I want to code about. But like it's at the end of the day is like if you have a platform without adoption, like it's not a success. It's just like you are, the mission is like to build something that helps others. So if it's not, that is not like really the goal that you are aiming for. The other thing is like, super critical is like building, if you're building a product, building a platform, building anything, you should have like a great documentation. Yep. Documentation is a key on like how to do things. Like even if you don't have the right automation to do things, like maybe building the simplest documentation that a user can understand makes a problem easier. Like if they follow 1, 2, 3 steps, that would be another thing to go through. And like you would also avoid like being in a support mode where like, you build something, it's working, but there are hundreds of use cases that people may go through. And then instead of like going through a documentation and people read about like, oh, this is how I fix it, they have to go ask. And then like you get into a situation where like you getting dragged into the support mentality for your platform. The last thing, which is super important, is feedback. Like customer feedback is like, has to be like iteratively, like every... I know if you can do it every day, I'll go for it. Like, this would be an overkill, but like in general, like you build a feature, you need to get like, feedback. You need to get like champion about it. You need to see what really people want. Like it might be like conflicting with what are you trying to do, but like this is where there's a value on like building that. So if you think like we should go this way, but everyone else think like if you build that, that would be helpful, you should start think about and listen to customers about what's really necessary. There are smaller things that smaller automations that could make it easier. Like one thing that I have been seeing, for example, and this is a personal experience to me.
Okay.
Like I know how to like deploy an app, for example, like in and out, like people work on a platform know how to do things. Then like you get it for granted that you think like it's an easy and like self-explained to other people. And then like you get into this problem like it's super easy, but like, yeah, I'm not saying it's not, it's easy because that's your day to day. But when someone else come to trying to use your tool, they don't necessarily know your tool. So like if you don't give them the right approaches and the right documentation, they're gonna just like feel like, oh, there's something missing. And then like smaller automation pieces and smaller bits can make the entire process easier. So instead of telling someone, hey, here's a list of 10 things, you could give them like a, maybe if you don't have automation, you could give them maybe a small bash script that does this 10 things, makes the process easier. So that would eliminate like user error, eliminate anything like that.
Okay. No, I think those are the useful tips. I'll make sure that I summarize those in the key takeaways section at the end of the episode. So like with Kubernetes Bytes, right? If you listen to any of the 2023 episodes, you'll see that we started a new question at the end. Like we asked people like, we asked a question to ChatGPT and got a response from it. And we asked the same question to our guest. And it was a funny question at the end, just a way to involve more AI. 2024, right? This is season 4 for us. What we are thinking is instead of doing that gimmicky bit, like actually ask, what are you doing with AI? Like, how is AI impacting your day-to-day? How are you planning on incorporating AI into your existing product or platform? Any of these things, like how are you thinking about AI today, Emma?
Yeah. So let me answer the question like in two parts, like part as an organization and part as separately, personally. So as an organization, I think like it's important to like look into AI and machine learning. And I know there are other folks like are looking at this area, but like there are stuff that we shared already. So like, for example, like if you go to open.nytimes.com, like we do have our open blog, and like you're gonna find articles about like, for example, like how our cooking teams are using machine learning to like do personalized stuff. You can read about like other things. So I don't think like it's something that we are not familiar with. Like other teams, we do have like machine learning teams in the organization that specifically do things with models, with data, and a lot of things. It's not my area of expertise to dive more. But like we do have the capabilities and the folks who are looking at something like that.
So before you go into the personal bit, right? So are you thinking about like long term, right? As part of this ever evolving platform, supporting something like a Kubeflow or an MLflow or some other model orchestration thing on top of Kubernetes, and maybe extending your customer or user base to even data scientists and not just developers. Is that going to happen?
I believe that is a vision that like personally I have in my mind. Like right now, like we are working with like services and like APIs and all of the kind of stuff, but there's another aspect of like how you do a lot of other things on Kubernetes, like how you do data batching, how you do data streaming, how you do machine learning, how you provide, like as we provide like a simple way of doing services and deployment, can we provide a simpler way? I have seen examples on like Jupyter as a service where like you can just like, hey, I need a quick thing to do.
A notebook,
a notebook. Yeah. And other things like I need to batch something. I need a batch job that does stuff. So it's completely on top of my head, like how we can evolve into this area. But like we also have data teams and like machine learning teams that we have to work with and orchestrate like how something like this works.
One of the benefits that I've seen like in other reInvent talks is like running Jupyter Kubeflow or any other Jupyter Lab notebook on EKS and combining it with the power of Carpenter. Whenever you actually want to execute your notebook, that's when Carpenter will spin up those additional GPU nodes. Once the job is done, it automatically spins it now. I was like, wow, that's awesome. And I brought this up in our last episode as well, but I love the move from AWS about open sourcing Carpenter. So it's not just restricted to AWS now. Like, you can use it with other cloud providers. Obviously, that will need some more work, but that option is out there, right? So if you're building with Carpenter, that's a great tool, which is now available to the open source audience.
Exactly. And you really nailed it. Like, I was really impressed by like how they thought about it. And then like I started recently, I think I saw a provider for Carpenter and AKS, which is Azure. So nice. Like it does the same logic, because the logic itself is really help with like scaling. Also, yep. We have seen like I think a couple of my colleagues did a talk about like how are we using Carpenter in KubeCon, in the last KubeCon, and like the idea on like things like spike fast or all of the kind of stuff. Carpenter is fully capable of that. So in the future, I'm like if I imagine like how I would see the platform from my personal experience or from my personal vision, I would see like why we don't have data, why we don't have other things. But it's more of a priority. What really helps the organization and how we can help the teams building what they need.
Gotcha. Makes sense. And let's go back to the second half of the AI question, right? Like, how are you using it on your own, like on your personal time?
Yeah, I'll tell you, like, it's super helpful. Like, when it started, like, I was a little bit skeptical about, like, all of the kind of stuff. But, like, I think, like, there's a lot of benefits of, like, not really, like, offloading things to it, but, like, being more productive. So, like, I'll get to tell you a simple example. Like, I want to share something. I want a nice image to share about what I'm doing. Like, yeah. Instead of me sitting and designing, it's not my area. Like, I know how I write a content, but like, yeah. I may not know how to create an image that's so beautiful. So like, I would prompt an AI to like build an image for me, and then it's done. But there are other things, like if it's doing, like if there's an automation, it's like, when I think about it, it's more of like, it's a tool to help me do my job better. Like, I would ask, like, one of the things I would ask is, like, I'm an engineer, but, like, do I remember every single code bit in my head? No, like, I understand what I'm doing, and I'm going to do it in a way that I think, like, it's architecturally correct, yeah. Like, logically correct, all of the kind of stuff. But what if I can have, if there's a repetitive task, or if there's something that I didn't see before, something that can go and do all of the searching behind the scene and get me the answers that I still have to apply or still have to look into. So personally, I find a lot of value. So like there's a K8S GPT, yep. Where like it's a CLI, which like it's super helpful to debug things. I didn't get a chance to like use it in work, but I'm using it personally to just play with and other things like that. But I would see a value on like going for more a structured way. Like if you ask me like, what I would like is just like a bot where like in AI would like, as an engineer, I would come and say, hey, I want to build a service. So like it would ask me a couple questions, and based on specific answers, it will start like, you know, tailor my experience to like, mm-hmm. Oh, now you need it public. Now you need that. Now you need that. And then like give me a template that I can start working on.
Yeah.
That's not a bad thing. Or when the logs, when I have one of my services not working correctly and I can just like, pass an error message and or it'll just like have some diagnostic collected together and like aggregated in a way that it's more human. I believe this is a good way. So I think we are going in the right track, in my opinion, on in general as an industry, how to go for it.
Yeah, we sure are, right? Like one of our previous guests on the episode runs a company called RunWen. They have a local tool called RunWen Local. And it does what you just said about troubleshooting. Like they have these AI assistant personas that are specifically trained on how you troubleshoot Postgres or how you troubleshoot Redis. You just point it to them and they'll run a bunch of commands and then identify the issue for you. So like you're not spending 4 hours troubleshooting something, you're spending 15 minutes figuring out, okay, this is the issue. How do I solve that specific issue? So check that out. Add it to your list of tools in addition to Kubernetes GPT.
I am.
Awesome. Okay. So that brings us to the last question. I know you already said open.newyorktimes.com, but where can people connect with you? With your team's journey, what new innovative things you're working on? How do people get in touch with you if they have more questions? Share any and all links that you might have.
Yeah, so Open the NY Times, that's where like we share all of our blogs and the amazing work that we are doing in the organization. We also on GitHub/NY Times, where like you can see all of the open source tools that we have. Personally, you can reach out to me on LinkedIn. I can just give you a link for my profile and people reach out to you. I'll include that
in our show notes. Yeah.
Or my email, and like happy to help and talk about anything that we have done and presented, and like even like not just like help, but like I would love people also to reach out and say we did our journey differently, and I learned from them on like what worked for them and how we can like collaborate with each other. I think that's the power of community at the end of the day.
Oh yeah, that's the perfect way to end the episode. Thank you so much, Ahmed, for joining us for this Kubernetes Bytes podcast recording, first of the new year and first of season 4. We love to have you back once you include AI ML as part of your platform. So if you do any talks in the future, I'll make sure that I watch those and reach back out to you. But yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me. And like, we'll be back one day.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. That was a great episode. Again, thank you, Ahmed, for joining us. But I would like to quickly summarize what we discussed in the episode, or at least have a few key takeaways, as Ryan and I usually do. So to start with, the first one being treat platform engineering as a product and not a process, or not a one-time thing. As a product, it has to be iterative, right? So you keep building the platform better with every release, make sure you're serving your users better, or maybe even adding more users to your platform. This is something I was thinking about, right? Like I know Facebook or Meta and Instagram and all of these SaaS companies, even Salesforce for that matter, when they do their earnings report, they list out their daily active users or DAU or monthly active users or MAU, I guess, to show the adoption of their platform or the usage of their application. I think, with platform engineering, that's something that we should be doing, right? Like if you are responsible for building a platform inside your organization, make sure that you are measuring somehow and making your product better such that like you're getting more and more users onboarded. I think Spotify, everybody knows they were the vendors behind Backstage project, and internally they use Backstage as well. Last year I was surprised that they have like 96% utilization from their engineering team for Backstage. So like 96% of Spotify developers actually use Backstage as their IDP to perform tasks and build their pipelines and release code to production. So if you are doing going on this platform engineering journey, make sure that you are treating your platform or an IDP as a product instead of just a feature or a one-time deliverable. Next key takeaway that I had from Ahmed's conversation was documentation, right? Documentation is the key, as he said. Even if sometimes you don't have automation for the entire pipeline or entire process, having documentation to fill those gaps, having those shell commands written down in a wiki, internal wiki, or an internal Slack or a Confluence page somewhere would help users, right? It's behind the thought process. Like if I'm doing something over and over again, it might make sense to me, but for my teammate or for a user in the same organization who's like three teams away from me, they might not understand or they might not know the entire process like I do. So documenting it is definitely a better solution to make sure that your users have an easier time adopting the platform. And then finally, feedback. Like as Ahmed said, feedback, gathering periodic feedback is absolutely essential. It helps you make sure that your features are built for the right audience. If not, you can tweak those. And you should also take this feedback to define what your roadmap looks like, right? As again, roadmap, because we're thinking about in our internal developer platforms as a product. So think about gathering feedback, maybe having a process in place where you have maybe a SurveyMonkey page, or maybe you have quarterly meetings. I know inside actual product teams, they do like customer technical advisory boards, right? Every quarter or every once every 6 months to share the roadmap, maybe gather some feedback or talk about issues your users might be having. Maybe think about implementing some of that as part of your internal organization to improve your IDPs. But yeah, I think those were all the things that caught my eye. If I missed something that you feel was a key takeaway, hit me up on Slack, hit me up on LinkedIn or Twitter, on my account or the Kubernetes Bytes account. But with that, I think that brings us to the end of today's episode. Please join our Slack channel. The way to find it or the way to find the link to join our Slack group is just go to our website, kubernetesbytes.com. Subscribe to our YouTube channel and please, please, please leave us good reviews, 5-star reviews, or at least some reviews on your wherever you listen to your podcast, right? Like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, anywhere. It helps us. It helps us use those algorithms to make sure we reach more audience. Again, we are in 2024, right? As part of one of my personal growth resolutions or growth goals is make sure we increase the audience from what it is today and take it to the next level. So anything you can do to help us would be great. Like Ryan will be back in future episodes and we'll continue doing this podcast. So without further ado, that brings us to the end of today's episode. I'm Bhavin, and thanks for joining another episode of the Kubernetes Bytes podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Kubernetes Bytes podcast.